This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thanks for joining us again. Hope you enjoyed part two of our interview with Ivar's Paul Herrera.
I noticed I read through some of the legislation that was either signed or in 2021 and 2022. Mm-hmm. And there was one reason I wrote this, that shared housing buildings, that was AB 682. And it was something that's, I just made a note, Carr opposed and made some changes and it got signed into law. You remember that law in particular?
I'm blanking on that one. I'm looking
Or shared housing buildings. I could have done better homework on that one. Let's talk about the process of getting legislation through, because I noticed there were two common areas or responses at the end of it. Died in committee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I gather most legislation dies in committee.
Yeah.
Occasionally gets signed, and then every once in a while vetoed by the governor. Mm-hmm. So I was really interested in one of them that was vetoed. Ownership of agricultural land by foreign governments passed. Mm-hmm. And then vetoed by the governor. So if it's something that had full support, let's say it had 100% support.
Yeah.
Is there, at the end of a veto, is there a revote that's possible?
It is technically possible. You can override a governor's veto. It hasn't happened. I was surprised by this too when I started getting involved and looking at working on state legislation, because I would see these bills that passed 80-0 in the assembly and
exactly, you
know, 38-0 in the Senate,
right,
vetoed by the governor. Like, why didn't they just override? Is it not possible? So I went back and looked at it. Oh, it is possible. It hasn't been done since like 1984.
Why? Because it would make them unpopular?
You know, I've asked and nobody really has a very good answer to it when I ask lawmakers, other than, you know, that the governor is very powerful in the state of California. The governor oversees quite a bit. And I'm not sure if it's just we're not going to get on his nerves, or sometimes they pass legislation and knowing full well,
100%, we have 100% of the legislatures passing it and then it gets vetoed. Yeah. That's just, that was my comment. Then what? Yeah. So the vetoed by the governor that foreign governments can't own California agricultural land, which does sound like a good idea not to let them do that. And then it's vetoed, but I think it's one of those votes that was unanimous. And then they didn't go after it and say, we want it anyway.
That one, my understanding is that there were some real considerations about whether it would stand up legally and could be enforced by the state of California as written, that there may have been a different way to approach it, but
it
wasn't going to work. And so the state would just be committed to a massive legal bill over something that may not have held up. They can do something along those lines, but maybe they need to sharpen their pencils a little bit about how they're going to approach it.
Does all legislation start with attorneys that know the process, or it can be somebody that just thinks they have a great idea and they put up a page outline and said, let's talk about this.
Bruce, I was about to ask along the same line of questions, because we've interviewed other folks, you know, Jordan Levine and, you know, Robert Kleinfeld, and they've mentioned that, you know, a lot of times they're not working with these legislators directly. It's their interns, it's their, you know, their administrative assistants, all those kind of people. So who are you directly working with, Paul, to try to move the needle one way or the other?
So let me go through the process a little bit. So, and I'll come back to that. So typically, you have a lawmaker that wants to accomplish a goal of they have some concept of what they want to do. And they and their staff will come together and think about so we don't want foreign governments to purchase California agricultural land. We think it's important. So the next step is to take their concepts, bullet point it, and send it over to legislative council. And there's a team of lawyers whose job it is to say, okay, how does this idea, how do we implement this by making changes to California's state code? And does it have to be added into it? Do we have to delete things? Do we have to amend things? And that's where you start the ball rolling on the process. And you start going into committees, start with this, and groups like us, right now, there's going to be 3,000 or 4,000 bills introduced and starting a few weeks ago and going through the next month or so. So then we got to find those things, right? Because you have overworked legal staff trying to take the wishes of the legislature and write it into code. And once we start looking at it, you start to see the problems crop up. You know, you're trying to solve problem X, but you're creating problems A, B, and C on the other side because it has to be implemented somehow. Or you have to create something that is implementable, or you run into constitutional problems in the California state constitution or the federal, the United States constitution. Or you create, massive problems in some other place. I'll give you an example about that. There was a lawmaker in the last session who introduced a bill to expand capital gains taxes, make them apply to most residential properties if the property was sold within 3 years.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you sold within 3 years, you paid cap gains on whatever the increase was in the property's value.
Whether you lived in it or not?
Whether you lived in it or not.
Okay.
They would consider you a speculator on that sense. Now, there's a lot of reasons why someone might have to move within 3 years. Your job changes, you're military and you're reassigned, or something happens in your life, you get married, you get divorced, et cetera, et cetera. So they really felt strongly about this because they saw people had profited quite a bit by purchasing homes in 2019, then they sell in 2022 to significant appreciation.
With non-taxable income.
Non-taxable, right? And so they wanted to discourage that. Well, here's the thing. The home, if they're living in the property and they're staying in California, whatever they're buying also went up by a similar amount.
Right.
So they're not exactly benefiting entirely from that change. And secondly, you're just imagine you buy a house in Corona in 2019 for $700,000, and you sell it in 2022 because you need a larger space, or you get divorced and so you're moving to a different place, and now it's $400,000 more expensive. And your escrow includes now about $80,000 line item for a tax bill you got to pay.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what the code was meant for. And so if the problem that the lawmaker is trying to address is that people are sitting on housing, speculating on it, and selling it 6 months later or a year later or 2 years later, that's a different kind of problem than what he's attacking is. The problem he's actually addressing is people are making too much money owning a house, I guess, mm-hmm. while doing nothing to address actual affordability, because the buyer of that property isn't going to benefit from the capital gains taxes being assessed to the seller. The buyer is going to pay whatever the price is. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't fix housing affordability, which is what the lawmaker talked about. Like, oh no, this will help make housing more affordable. No, it just helped California make more money, and dip a spoon into the flow of cash, and scoop some out of there.
Yeah, and sometimes it doesn't. They had there was a year, maybe 2 years, where they raised cap gains all the way to the top tax level, federal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then they lost revenue because people said, "Well, heck with that, I'm just won't sell my stock."
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And Joey, to your question about, when do we get involved? We have to read through all this stuff. And there's many times when bills that aren't designed to have a whole lot to do with housing, they're changing part of the code that impact housing in a way that they didn't see, because they were focused, their eye was on a different ball. But we have to read through all this stuff and say, wait a minute, the thing you just did is going to make it much harder to permit a home or, you know, so a lot of these bills that you'll see where it'll say it was amended to committee or CAR opposed and then changed to neutral after amendments. Oftentimes it's because the lawmaker wasn't trying to target housing. They were trying to do something about, I don't know, parks or the arts in an area. But the way it was written, it was too broad and it was going to have an impact on housing. And so once we talked to the lawmaker, they said, okay, I'm not trying to hurt housing at all. I'm not trying to make it harder to get a permit to build a house. So let's go ahead and write in an amendment that removes that impact. And then we say, okay, you know, you do what you need to do, or what you deal with the other interest groups that care about the issue. But our issue has been settled because, you know, we were going to end up being, collateral damage for, you know, a parks preservation bill or something.
So when it gets to the ballot, is that like, oh man, we didn't see this one and now we have to oppose it and we have to like create, you know, awareness to oppose it and make sure it doesn't happen, or is it stuff that you catch and that it's just going to make it because the legislature or, you know, the legislator is going to make sure that it gets on the ballot.
When you say the ballot, you mean the propositions that come to voters?
Like once it gets to the voter, like, is that something oh man, we blew it. We missed it. Now we got to oppose it.
That's a totally different process.
Okay.
So what I'm referring to are bills that the legislature votes on. The initiatives that go to the public, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why those go on there. Sometimes groups create propositions as a negotiating tool with the state legislature. When you look at the one that shows up every 2 years, dialysis clinics. death match.
I didn't mean to derail the conversation where it was at. So sure. that was just a thought that I had.
Yeah, well, it's different.
Well, okay. Well, what makes it different? I guess let's talk about that, because a lot of legislation, when I read through these laws, they have impact on the people of California. Mm-hmm. We never got to vote on that. So what rules are in place that say, okay, the people of California get to vote on this section of bills, but not these, but there's laws passed all the time that we don't get to vote on. So what are the two categories if you can do that?
Yeah, I think there's three categories that come to voters. Number one is California allows direct democracy. So voters can sign onto a petition to take a law and put it before a statewide vote as a proposition. So like those dialysis laws, our Prop 19 on tax transferability, those are laws where, in our case, Prop 19, we drafted it, we submitted it for review, and then we have a certain amount of time in which to gather, in our case, about 1 million signatures, valid signatures, verify those. And then once that's done, it is going to be on a ballot going to the future. So you can create laws, which creating laws also includes deleting or amending existing laws, through direct democracy, through signature gathering. The state legislature can also vote to place an initiative on the ballot that does the same thing. That happens from time to time. Or if something requires a change in the state's constitution. So for instance, Prop 13 is written into the...
I was just gonna ask you about that. Okay.
Yeah. Prop 13 is written into the California constitution. Lawmakers can't amend it. Voters have to amend it. So if they want to do, for instance, split roll, which they would like to do, which is to remove or significantly weaken Prop 13 protections from commercial property, they have to go to the voters and the voters have to approve that. The legislature has no ability to change that because that was a state constitution that did it.
Okay, so how is that different than when we voted, we had on the ballot 1 year that a rent control and we voted against that. So the people of California voted against rent control. Mm-hmm. And then we got it.
Yeah, voting down a law is not the same as approving one by voters.
Okay.
So if the voters create a law, the legislature can't change that. If the voters decline to take, you know, voting no is the equivalent of taking no action.
Well, but voting no was a statement by the public that we don't want it, but then we weren't asked a second time when we got rent control. So how did that take a different path? Instead of voting in the public, how did it go through the legislature, and why was it a different approach the second time? Okay, let's pass it and not have the public vote on it either or.
It was different. The law affected things differently. So the first version was funded by one particular group that was frustrated the local governments were not allowed to do certain things with rent control, such as attach it to new construction or have what's called a vacancy control, which means that rent control stays on the unit even after the occupant leaves.
Okay.
And the legislature had no, and to this point has still not made changes to those items. And this group wanted to see those things put on the table so they could expand rent control in Los Angeles and the Bay Area, for instance. And so they were willing to pay to put that on the ballot. And the voters, and we opposed, I think that was Prop 5 in, what was it, Prop 10 in 2018, if not mistaken. The version that passed a couple years later, AB 1482, that was the rent cap and just cause eviction law, still maintained a lot of those earlier restrictions of local governments and preempted some local governments to the extent that the California Apartment Association, for instance, they did not oppose the final version. I think we were the last group standing that was opposed to 1482 at the end. Mm-hmm. But there might have been, I think there was one rental property group that stayed in opposition. But a number said, okay, we've cut the best deal we can. We'll go to neutral. We continued opposing it at that stage. But that was approved by the legislature. Now, if we had, any group can take a law that passes and say, we're going to raise the money and the signatures to run a referendum on this law. And then it goes to voters. That's very, very expensive.
Okay.
So like the bail bond industry did that. The California legislators voted to eliminate cash bail. The bail bond industry put that on a ballot as a referendum. You saw that with Uber and Lyft on the independent contracting things. They put it on the ballot partly as a referendum and partly to codify a new way of doing things going forward.
Okay.
Anything? So I don't know if I'm clarifying anything, by the way.
No, that's helpful. 2023, what do we have any legislation that you're looking at going, we got to work on that so that doesn't pass, or any subjects that are really hot for 2023?
We've just started. So the legislative, the way the California legislative cycle works is after the elections, a new legislature is sworn in, and anything that was on the table before is wiped off and we start from scratch.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So we're there now. We're everything's being introduced. You're seeing a lot of legislation that is almost just an outline of where they want to go. So clearly, California is still working through housing affordability problems. Clearly, the state is trying to figure out just how aggressively to press cities on approving new housing and expanding housing in their general plans. California has gotten a lot more aggressive about this than they have in the past. They're actually enforcing laws that have been on the books for 40 years in many cases, but that the state in the past would just kind of let cities get away with.
Right.
And so you're seeing a lot more projects getting approved or a lot more opportunities for that to take place. You're also seeing some backlash from cities. Cities that don't appreciate losing the ability to say no.
Exactly.
There's going to be some challenges to that. We've as an organization, we've traditionally been a more local control organization that felt that cities and local governments should be given a wide berth to make decisions on what should and shouldn't be built. We've shifted on that question. Because over this last generation, that just became a lot of no when it came to housing.
Absolutely.
And that needed to change. You go back into the 40s, 50s, and 60s, into the 70s. And most housing was built by right. You know, you had a plot of land. It was zoned residential. You went and got a permit. You didn't have to go and present your plans at a public meeting so that the neighbors could come yell at you and for a planning commission to say, no, you can't build that. Even though you have a piece of land, it's residential, you're meeting building code, and you're not, like, no, they just don't want it there. Became an argument.
A man I'm very familiar with, he sent me the classic email this year. He was so excited. He finally got his land in, I think it was Murrieta or Menifee, all of it approved.
Mm-hmm.
19 and a half years after he started the process, and $5.5 million out of pocket without touching the land or putting in a pipe or a road. That's the journey that he went through.
Yeah. I mean, the process got insane. You know, this feeling that we had to run to the public for every single thing that happened, and you had a right to say what your neighbors did when it wasn't harming you. You know, you have a right to not be harmed by what your neighbors do. You don't have a right to not be annoyed. You know, if you don't like it, tough.
Yeah, there's noise in construction. Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
Paul, in your opinion, this issue, does it get solved by the legislature helping the people or helping the industry?
I'd say those two things are the same. Because the fact that we have restricted building to the extent that we have mean that the people don't have a place to live and that the costs are, you know, far exceeding what they would be if market demand had been allowed to be satisfied by market supply, as it had happened for, you know, generations before that. We created these restrictions on building. You know, I have this idea that I want to have, you know, you go to a city council meeting, you fill out a speaker card, you know, my name is so-and-so and I want to speak on this issue. I would like to have a permanent speaker card at the city of Riverside that just says, whatever someone wants to build is fine with me. And just enter that into the record every time somebody has got something. They want to build it, it's fine with me. Because I think if you ask most voters aren't at City Hall, you know, so you get 30 or 40 people coming out on an item in a city of 300,000. And those 30 or 40 people scare the 5 or 7 people up on the dais saying, oh, my God, the community is up in arms against this. Like, no, it's like it's 30 people,
So you said that's kind of the same. But the answer that I hear, and maybe this is just my perspective, mm-hmm. is that you feel like by them helping and making it easier for the market or the industry to do its job and to, you know, perform is going to eventually help the people. So maybe the law should be skewed to help, you know, the industry rather than the people.
My view, and I'm a little bit more permissive on it than maybe other people would be. My view is that in the democracy that we have, you need a very good reason to stop people from exercising basic property rights and the ability to engage in commercial activity. You don't need a good reason to permit it. You know, you shouldn't have to justify why you want to do something. You need to justify why you want to use government power to stop that thing from happening. And we really moved in the other direction. Like, well, you know, why should we build? Why should we allow the construction of this unless you can show me why it's necessary? No, you got to show me why it's necessary to stop it. You know, why it's a public hazard, a real detriment that's going to harm individuals, and not just because you don't like it.
You know, yeah, I think if you rated states as far as their opinion of what you're allowed to do with what you own, Florida and Texas would probably be 1 and 2, and California would be 50th. And that's not good. That isn't good. Last time I interviewed you, I remember saying to you that I read the Bill of Rights just before I interviewed you, because it was in my mind the same kind of thing that you just said, is that the local government seems to be able to have a lot of power over what you thought were your property rights.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's legitimate restrictions that you want to look at, right? I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago, Bruce, there was a...
What's wrong with lead paint?
Sorry?
What's wrong with lead paint?
Yeah. I remember the explosion at a chemical factory in some community in Texas, and there was like a adjacent school and houses. And I was thinking, why is there a chemical factory next to school and houses? Like there are some limits that you do want to look at. You know, you don't want to permit certain activities over a water table. Those are legitimate restrictions. You know, traffic is too bad already and we shouldn't build more housing is not a legitimate restriction. You know, especially since housing doesn't create people. You need, you know, a male and a female to produce human beings. Housing just allows the people who already exist to have a place to live.
Well, Paul, thanks for looking out for our industry's well-being all these years. You know, the way you described all you have to read, are you a speed reader?
I'm very good at scanning through and seeing things that don't interest me.
Okay.
And by extension, probably don't interest you guys. So I'm pretty good at scanning. There's a lot of packing peanuts inside of legislation that you can just, you know, push aside very quickly. So Bruce, in the next couple of months, we'll have a much better handle on some of the specific bills that are coming up.
Okay.
We'll do a lot of negotiating. There's a lot of things that will look real scary at first blush. You'll probably see them on social media somewhere. And by the time it comes around a couple weeks later, we will have negotiated out some of the worst of that. And we'll start, pinpointing what are the places where we're going to have a clash and we have some work to do. So 4 to 6 months from now, if you want to talk some more, I'll be much more specific than I can be today.
It looks like September is a magic month for signing things. Is that accurate?
Typically September. Yeah, because the state in even years when there's an election, the state legislature must finish its business at the end of August.
Okay.
And the governor has the next month in order to sign or veto.
Yeah, I saw almost everything I saw was September 28th or 29th for vetoing or agreeing to it. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of bills that get passed in the last 2 days of session.
Yeah. All right, Paul. Thanks for taking time out of your day and joining us.
Of course. Anytime, Bruce.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the hard money tab.